It is 12:35, February 18, 2011. We're back on the record in the FRM hearings as called by the New Hampshire Secretary of State. This is Presiding Officer Charles Chandler. Our first witness today afternoon is Attorney James Shepherd, but before we go there, do we have any preliminary matters, Attorneys Forcier or Spill?
Yes, Mr. Chandler. I have redacted exhibit number 116 and 117 that were just entered this morning. I have redacted the personal information off of those documents. I want to re-enter them at this time.
Okay. I'm accept them for re-entry. For the record, the redactions eliminate information which might jeopardize the privacy of private individuals.
And I'd like to reserve the other documents for the end.
Okay. There being nothing else, I'm ready to proceed with the first witness for the afternoon. That's Mr. Shepherd. Mr. Shepherd, as I recall, you're a member of the New Hampshire Bar, therefore no need to be sworn, subject to the canons of ethics.
Thank you.
Attorney Spill.
Thank you for appearing here today, Mr. Shepherd. Jeff Spill from the Bureau of Securities Regulation, and thank you, Mr. Pendleton, as well. There was an issue at the last time you testified about confidentiality, and since that time we've revisited the confidentiality issue and believe we have that resolved. So we'd like to go back to your statement that you gave to the DOJ in April of 2010 and ask you, is there any, you've had a chance to review that, correct?
Yes.
Is there anything about that statement that appears inaccurate to you, that it's something you don't believe was transcribed properly or was misinterpreted?
Yes.
Okay, can you elaborate?
Sure. I leave it to attorneys Marshall and Head whether they accurately wrote down their notes. They weren't my notes of the conversation. I didn't make notes of the conversation. So for me to point out inaccuracies, the only thing I'm going to be able to point to is what are, to me, glaring and apparent inaccuracies in it. So if there are small inaccuracies between what I said and what they wrote down and then what eventually got made onto paper, I'm not fully aware of that because I don't remember the exact conversation.
I understand fully. What we want is your recollection of what we transcribed.
Okay. When I had been reviewing this before in preparation for today's testimony, there was one, let me just see if I can find it so that everyone can be on the same page.
Could you suspend for just a minute?
Can I have a copy for you if you'd like?
Well, I've got mine here too. Okay. Give me a minute and I will find it. I have it. Please proceed.
There is a paragraph that begins at the very bottom of page 2 and concludes on the top of page 3. And the substance of the paragraph concerns violations of Graham-Leach-Bliley. And the paragraph concludes with the statement, because there were so many of these types of violations and the practices varied, he thought that loan originators should be individually licensed. That statement is inaccurate. I never believed that loan originators should be individually licensed. Although I may have commented to the attorneys general that were there that I found it very frustrating that it was difficult to take individual action against individual loan originators. And I'm cognizant of the fact that in between the time that I left the Department of Banking and the time of this review, legislative changes were made so that loan originators are now individually licensed. And so that might have been the source of the confusion on that particular point. But that jumped out at me when I was reading it again last night, that it wasn't something that was not something that I said.
Is there any other aspects of this five-page statement that is dated April 27, 2010.
There was one other one. I'm trying to find that one. There is, and this might have been a misunderstanding between me and the attorneys general that were there in terms of our mixing of terminologies, but it's not clear from the memo, but there was... when I started at banking, my immediate supervisor was Donna Susi, who then that November, I started in the fall, so I think October. That November, there was, if you'll recall, a radical change in the nature of the legislature, and the new majority in the Senate picked as its counsel my then boss. So she left very shortly after I started, and then there was a gap of time before Abby Shane started. That's not clear from the memo, but I just, and that's just a picayune detail, but it's just there's a little bit of inconsistency there, which I don't know where that arises from. But I think otherwise it's generally an accurate description of the conversation that we had.
Sure. I'll call your attention to the bottom of page 3, starting with the last paragraph and going to the top of page 4, finishing that paragraph and then starting into the second paragraph of page 4. Does that appear to be something that you told Mr. Marshall?
Yes.
Mr. Head?
Yes.
And does that appear to be accurate?
Yes.
Okay. Did, with respect to the comment that a case did not go well. Let me see if I can get your exact words. It starts at the bottom of page 3 and goes into page 4. You did not have the details as to what she based her comments on, but his impression was that something had happened in the case involving the Gallagher office. The interview showed that was satisfied with the outcome. Do you see that?
Yes.
Was there a specific case that she referenced, or did she give more detail about what it was that didn't go well?
I don't think she specified a case. And the impression that I had at the time was a very generalized impression. It was more in the line of a colleague giving me, it was my first day on the job, so it was more in the line of a colleague saying, you know, here's some of the things that you have to do and not do that work, kind of thing. So it wasn't specific in that regard.
Is there any other aspects of those two paragraphs that she told you that don't appear in those two paragraphs that you can recall?
Maybe. Do you mean, is there more that I know about that particular situation than
yes,
what's
exactly
in those paragraphs?
Well, that she told you.
Not that Andrea Shaw told to me, no.
Is there somebody else that told you something?
There is more information to the story, if that's what you're asking me. And I think based on the information from Celia Leonard, then I feel that I'm permitted to be able to discuss that in this forum. This might answer a bunch of different questions from a bunch of different paragraphs. I'm not going to try to reference the memo. Andrea Shaw made those warning commentary towards me. Like I said, it was my first or second day on the job. And it was in the vein of, these are things you have to watch out for, and these are the things you have to do. And I had no understanding at that time, as no new employee does, I had no understanding at that time what the dynamic was at all. Over the course of the next several months, I had an opportunity to deal with the commissioner, Chris Gallagher, cases that had Andrea Shaw had formerly worked on, and an opportunity to have conversations with the banking department, the other banking department employees, about Andrea Shaw's work in particular and her relationship with the banking commissioner. And that those interactions cast my impression of that first conversation in a completely different light.
Okay. If you'd like to. I can see you. It's not a very comfortable conversation that we're having here. But, you know, the purpose of this hearing is to get it all out on the record. So if you want to elaborate, go ahead.
I think it was the considered lay opinion of the other employees of the banking department that Andrea Shaw was not a very good lawyer, and that what happened in that particular case that Andrea Shaw was not happy with was that Chris Gallagher, who was a personal friend of the commissioner, called up the commissioner and told the commissioner what Andrea Shaw was doing, and Andrea Shaw got her hand slapped, is my educated opinion about what transpired based on all of my interactions with the people at banking.
Is there anything that you think we're leaving out as far as that you want it to be a complete statement?
Well, I wanted to be clear that, and I think in reading over the memo, and I don't think it was any intention on the author's part, but the way the memo comes across is there's some kind of implication that there was some improper relationship between the banking commissioner and Chris Gallagher, and I don't think that that's a fair and accurate rendition at all. And I think, as I said in my earlier testimony, my dealings with Attorney Gallagher were entirely above board. I was glad whenever it turned out that he and his firm were involved in a case, because that usually made things easier. There's a description of a conversation that I had with the commissioner about a case, in the memo that talks about that the commissioner came to me specifically about one particular case. And it wasn't a client of Attorney Gallagher's. It was something that Attorney Gallagher had asked the commissioner about. I had the impression, although no one said this, I had the impression that that person had approached the Gallagher firm to represent them, and they never did end up representing them. And I think it's because I told the commissioner these people are criminals and we're probably going to be referring them out to the AG's office. And lo and behold, the Gallagher firm never entered an appearance in that case. It could be coincidental, but
I think that's probably about all you have to say about that, I think. So I have no further questions.
I just want to be abundantly clear, just so there's absolutely no confusion of any kind whatsoever. In that last recollection of your observations and conversations, is it fair to say you were not discussing FRM or CLNM Inc.?
Yes, that's fair to say. Okay. Right. And to be completely clear, I never thought at the time that FRM was doing anything that would get them referred to the AG's office for criminal enforcement based on what I had seen up to that point when I was at banking. I thought they were sloppy and they had some issues, but I didn't think, based on, in terms of banking laws, that they were doing anything that was so bad. I mean, you have to remember, this is at the height of the refinance bubble. We had people that had no jobs, no income, getting mortgages for $500,000 at the time. So, I mean, there were different problems in the banking industry than throwing pieces of paper away with Social Security numbers on them.
I understand. I just wanted to be clear about your recollection in the conversation.
Yes, as far as I know, and I'm fairly certain it didn't have anything to do with FRM or CLNM or Financial Resources Mortgages of the Lakes Region, Inc., which I think is what they first started out being.
Okay. I have nothing further. I want to thank you very much.
Let me have one question. Can we ask a follow-up?
If you wish.
You referenced, you said something to the effect of you were glad when that firm was representing a client that was of interest to the banking department. Can you elaborate on that? Why it made things, like, I think you used the word easier or better?
Maybe I can cast it in general terms, and then if you have specific follow-ups, you can ask them. At my time at banking, it was the first legal position that I held where I had regular interaction with opposing counsel. There were law firms that I was not happy to see on the other side of the item, and there were law firms that I was happy to see on the other side of the item. The Gallagher Law Firm was one of the firms that I was happy to see on the other side of the item. That was usually because, regardless of who was actually handling the case, I knew if I was having problems with getting what I needed to resolve the case, I could put a phone call into Chris Gallagher and get the issue resolved. If it was a matter of somebody, some lawyer in the firm is stalling me on getting something that I thought was clearly within the ambit of what I could get under the statute, I'd go right to Chris and he would get it for me. So that made me happy that he was on the case, because it made my job easier to do.
You just have a minute.
Okay. Will there be an additional follow-up?
One additional follow-up, Mr. Shepard. Does your position, has the AG, the Attorney General's Office, advised you that your position at the Department of Safety is also a position at the Attorney General's Office, that they're sort of, you report to both? Is that correct?
I think by virtue of the fact that, I should say that differently. At the Department of Safety, I hold the position of hearings examiner. I'm specifically assigned to the prosecution unit right now. As such, any decisions that I make in that vein are ultimately accountable to the Attorney General's office, because the Attorney General's office is the chief law enforcement officer of the state. So I don't know that I have... Well, I should say that differently. I've never gotten any specific direction from the Attorney General's office that I'm subject to their control or authorization or anything like that. I'm also aware, I'm not really sure the breadth of your question, but I'm aware that every state agency has the AG's office as their counsel. So, there's those two things. But I've never been specifically advised by any member of the AG's office that I'm subject to their directions.
Thank you for clarifying. May I ask one more additional
one
follow-up?
More.
Although Attorney Maloney represented FRM and CLNM, would you ever talk...
Never represented CLNM.
I'm sorry. Mr. Maloney represented FRM, not CLNM. I understand that to be true as well. Would you ever talk to Chris Gallagher about issues with that, specifically Chris Gallagher, or were you dealing with Maloney? Mr. Maloney?
I don't remember ever talking to an attorney about FRM. I might have, but I just don't remember ever having talked to an attorney about FRM. I remember talking to Susan LaDuke about FRM on one or two occasions. And I think that my comments in the memorandum are accurate in that regard, which is that she assisted, it was my... it was my understanding from the bank examiner who was conducting an on-site review at that time that Susan LeDuc was doing a good job of helping them to clean up their paperwork issues.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you for coming today.
Okay. One moment, please. How long was Abby Shane your supervisor, if you recall?
I don't remember when she arrived. And she was my supervisor until I left.
Okay. And you left in 2007, is my recollection?
I'm sorry?
Did you leave in 2007? Is that my
recollection? 2008.
2008.
Yes, summer, either late summer or early fall. No, it was in the summer of 2008. I competed in a triathlon after that, so no.
Good for you. I have nothing further, and I want to thank you for coming in to clarify. It's quite meaningful for me. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to ask him a question before we leave today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Attorney Forcier, do we have an additional witness this afternoon, is that correct?
We do. Mr. Ron Stone wishes to take the stand. Do we have a name, Placker?
No, we don't. No.
Unfortunately, it's the last minute, so we don't have a name.
That's fine. That's fine. Mr. Stone, if I recall correctly, you have testified by telephone in this matter.
Right.
I honestly don't recall at the end of that conversation whether I informed you that if you were to testify again, you would remain under oath.
Yes, you do.
Well, I'm going to swear you in just in case I didn't do that. You raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give. The matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God.
Yes, I do.
Would you state your name, spelling your last name for the record, please?
Ronnie Paul Stone, and my name is Stone.
Okay, and Mr. Stone, my understanding is that you've asked to testify and. I'm open to hearing your testimony this afternoon.
Okay. I just want to add a few things that I thought were in my wife's testimony that she presented to you on, I don't know what the day it was, but
I have.
It came to light today that there were a few things that were missing there.
Please do.
You know, there was an article printed in the paper here. It's on January 15th. It was concerning the bankruptcy hearing, and one of the hearings was about Burke and Gould being basically not involved, that they were just innocent. They were duped into this whole Ponzi thing. That is an outright lie. They represented Scott Farrer in 2005 in my court case. They were his lawyers. They were privileged to all my information. They depositioned me. They knew everything that was involved with Scott and Bob Farrer, the Santa Harbor Christian Church, and we testified to them for, actually I did a deposition for probably 16 hours, I believe it was, and that is available to you. And in that deposition, you can see Gould asking me questions. And you can see that I answered almost everything that's happened to these people happened to me in 2005. All this Ponzi scheme, the whole thing, it wasn't CLM then, it was JLN. It was another guy, Richard Rollick. He did this ghost bank for Scott. And it's the same scenario. It just moved over. They couldn't use him anymore after I brought them to light. So they used Dodge. Now, back when we did our deposition, my wife got a hold of Mr. Dodge because his name appeared on the documentation for the church.
as one of the founding fathers, along with Scott Farrer and Bob Farrer. Bob Farrer was the president, and there was another man's name on there that I don't recollect. Anyways, my wife talked to him for over 2 hours on the phone, because I sat there because I had to listen to it. And at no time did he ever mention that he had any involvement with Bob Farrer. In fact, he denied that he had any knowledge of any, you know, Bob Farrer and Scott Farrer, that he had any involvement with them. And this is 2005. So my wife had laid out the whole case to him. And when I listened to all these testimonies and things from all these people who are obviously liars, I mean, Scott Farrer has pleaded to guilty on this already. And everything is coming to light with these. They're having the same problems I had. They're getting nowhere. They have nobody in government that's stepping forward and saying, hey, you know, we need to hear this. This is the first time anybody's actually had a chance to talk to anybody and give the story. And I listened to Mr. Bean here, and, you know, you got the AG's office. It just seems that this is a complete sham with the AG's office. I mean, you got the prosecutor for the case, who used to be in the AG's office in this period of time. He's prosecuting it. Scott Farrer gets a deal. He's getting two charges of felony for stealing $30 million and two people committing suicide. He should be up on manslaughter charges. You got, it's just ridiculous. You got Roth, who is the assistant, standing up for Gould, saying that he had nothing to do with it. He's duped. It's an article. Here he is. They don't even attach Gould's stuff because of Roth, who's the AG's office. The criminals are getting more help from the AG's office than the people that are being victimized. This is ridiculous. And that's the way I see this. But today I saw that we happened to have a conversation, and Gould's name came up, and Mr. Bean here mentioned that, gee, he hadn't heard Gould. He was basically going to go free. And there's nothing going against Gould here. Of course, I wouldn't know this. I'm not in the state. But he's up to his ears in it. He was in Scott's office. He did all the paperwork for Scott on everything that, when I was doing business with him, Gould was involved. So he knows all of what has happened. And all of his assets were achieved from working with Scott. So I don't know why he's not being punished for this, too.
Who deposed you in 2005?
Well, it was Chris Carter, and then it was Gould, and then it was, I believe his name was Brown, for Bob Farrer, Attorney Brown. I'd have to ask my wife.
But clearly, it was Attorney Gould. Was Attorney Burke there during that deposition?
No, Burke was not there.
Do you have that deposition?
I can get you a copy. You should have been able to get one from Carter.
Well, I would ask if it's possible for you to get me a copy. And I would want you to certify on the final page of it, to the best of your recollection, as a true and accurate copy of the 2005 deposition.
Yeah, very good.
If you will do that, I will accept that, and again, it'll just be one of many things that I'll review and attach whatever probative value that I deem appropriate to it. But I would receive that. You can forward that to Attorney Spill or Attorney Forcier at the Bureau, and they will see that it gets to me.
Yeah, because when this all finally hit the fan, you know, I said to my wife, we need to sit back and just watch what comes forward from the state to defend these guys. And this first guy came forward was Mr. Roth. And he was in another case that I'm aware of, and you are too, and I'll just call it A, where he was the prosecuting attorney, and there were people that stood up in that trial and said that Scott Farrer was involved in it and was a crook. And he was working for the AG's office at that time, and that's back in 2005, and nothing was done. Zippo. You know, when this was solved, this case was solved, and we were paid off in 2005, and basically they settled with us because they had no choice. My wife and I, we just moved out of here because we couldn't even, you know, we didn't know where we were going to get attacked from. You know, we didn't know if this went higher than Scott. This is just not Scott. You know, what you have for information from Scott is nothing. You know, it was what Scott wanted you to find. You know, in 1 month, he did $11 million worth of business. All right? You found nothing. You know, you found what he wanted you to find, and what he prepared for you to find, and what you've got is the people he knew that would be coming in here. And the people that died and he got money from, and the people that you just don't even know how to get to him or get it back, you haven't even seen them. Or, you know, I mean, his old man, him and his father, you cannot tell, in 2005, you cannot tell the separation between them. The money went from every month into the bank account, the church. The reason you guys don't see that now is because of me. They got smarter. They stopped doing the things that they were doing. They used to do documents, and they would actually register them with the whatever county, and their names would be on it. You know, they stopped doing that. You can't find that stuff anymore. They weren't putting the money in a bank account at $80,000 at Laconia Trust, and taking $80,000 from the beginning of the month to zero at the end of the month. They had a zero balance every end of the month, and then there'd be another $50,000 in there. You know, so those were the documents that we were seeing. Unfortunately, before this all hit the fan, I threw all that away. I had probably 8 or 9 boxes full of documents that I had collected over a year of researching Scott Farrer. But every time we complained to somebody, we got no help. Nobody cared. It was like, you know, so.
Where did you go to complain?
Well, that's where I'm sketchy on this, because I thought we went to the AG's office. I guess it was the U.S. Attorney General's office. That was my lawyer. So Chris Carter informed them of the whole case, of what was going on. I physically came over here to complain at one point, but there was nothing. I forget which floor I went to, and it's changed a little bit. So I was going to walk around earlier, but I didn't get a chance to. I went over. There's a building over that way, and I'm not sure what that is, if that's the securities or if that's the banking, or it was on the other side of the highway. As you go up to the motor vehicles, you take a right. It used to be down in that area, and I'm not sure what that was. But there I was told I had to do a written thing, and I never did it. So, but believe me, I had $250,000 invested with these guys. And, you know, and this is back in 2005. Half of that was my dad's money. He's in a retirement home. You know, he needed the higher interest to stay there, $4,000 a month. You know, I was willing to take a little bit of a risk. I knew the people. I went to the church. Unlike these victims, you know, I knew these people on a personal basis. You know, I mean, I talked to Scott at least once a week at church, and probably a couple times during the week. I mean, we actually would snowplow together, or I had dinner over there. I went to a Tyson fight over there, you know, the last fight I ever went to, where he bragged about how he just gave his wife a brand new Steinway piano for $35,000, you know, or he gave me a grand tour of his new addition for $125,000. He paid cash. Well, come to find out, when we finally get their documentation of how much they earn, he was making $35,000 a year back then. But he paid cash, $125,000, for an addition on his house. You know, it just, and I listened to the stuff of these people that testify, his wife, I know nothing. Well, you know what? I mean, I can't hold water with me. I'm not buying it. She's got 100 trust funds. My wife gave me a $35,000 bass boat. I'll tell you something, I'd ask her where the money came from. All right? You know, this is stupid. I mean, this stuff is stupid. You get a $125,000 addition on your house and it's free and clear. I'd be asking questions. She's an RN. She's a registered nurse. She's got a college education. She went to 4 years of, I think she went to Oral Roberts. I mean, come on. And these people, as far as I can see, I don't see anybody going after them. And the way this all looks to me, laying it out on the table, is there's been a deal made behind the doors. I mean, you've got somebody that worked at the AG's office prosecuting. You've got AGs popping up everywhere. You know, McLaughlin, he's the 2000 AG. He's defending, I forget who, in here. I mean, yeah, it's nuts. I don't get it. Nobody's checking nobody. What is the deal here?
Hopefully, Mr. Stone, by the time we pour through all this and we produce our report, we will get it. And that's where we're headed.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for doing this,
well,
because it doesn't seem like anybody else is doing
it. I want to thank you and everyone else who has come forward and testified. It's what's made the difference with these hearings as opposed to other looks at the problem.
Yeah.
Again.
But, you know, the bottom line is Scott has separated himself from his family. Okay, when you guys, when they had this trial, the way it looked to me is that he just, you know, backed away from everything. You know, his father's on the TV saying, you know, hey, I have nothing to do with this, whatever. But he's received $50,000 a year from CHC as contributions, you know, basically. His pay per year, by the way, back then was $50,000. Isn't that a coincidence? And, you know, but he has nothing to do. You know, he gives the poor pastor speech every time.
Can we close that door, please?
On. But, you know, basically, I'm almost ashamed of being a New Hampshire person. I really am. I thought it meant to be something here. I, even though I don't live in the state, when somebody asks me where I live, I'm from New Hampshire. You know, it's just, this stuff is, it's aggravating, you know, and I've lived 5 years of it, 6 years of it, so.
Thank you for your testimony this afternoon. I appreciate that. And rest assured, there's some very good people in the state of New Hampshire, and we're going to do our best to sort through this and get to the bottom of this. We really are. Attorney Forcier or Attorney Spill, do we have other matters this afternoon?
I would like to introduce some additional documents and make a brief statement, and I think Mr. Miller wishes to make a statement as well.
Excellent. Let's start with the documents.
Sure. I have for you here the depositions you were referring to earlier today. The deposition of Scott Farah, dated January 14th, and the second day of his deposition is dated January 18th, 2011. These are not signed yet. But my understanding is the signature is being waived by law. But you said you wanted to wait until Tuesday to accept this?
For the record, since today is, all things being equal, the last day of open oral testimony, I'm accepting these depositions of Scott Farah done at the United States Bankruptcy Court. The acceptance is delayed until close of business on Monday. The absence of a signature on a deposition means that I really can't give it full credence, but I can after a 30-day time period has passed. It will have passed by close of business on Monday, I think.
And I can continue to check to see with Ms. Nollinger to see if and when that does get signed.
Well, we'll know by end of business on Monday whether it's signed or whether there's some unforeseen opposition to its being in existence. I mean, that isn't going to happen. I mean, the reality is it's something that we can't envision as we sit here today. So I would assume by close of business on Monday, we would mark that and take that as exhibit, and it would be available for the public after that point in time at Notch Hill.
I also have for you Ms. Andrea Shaw's interrogatory answers.
I'll take those, and we'll have those marked. I've seen those for the record.
This
is 118.
As you, may I continue?
Let me just look at this for just a second. These are signed and acknowledged. I'll accept those.
As you're well aware of the National Inspection Repair lawsuit, I just have the court documents associated with that case. It's the statement of the case, I think the original factual background. This is just some additional information for you so you can understand the NIR case more thoroughly. I'm not sure if the record is clear on exactly what happened with NIR, so I think this would shed some additional details.
What's the source of this information?
I received this from Al and Susan McElveen, who did their own research to find these documents. Would you like them to stand up?
I think I would like one of them to authenticate the document.
Susan McElveen will take
Okay.
Would you like her to look at it briefly? Or?
Yeah, I asked her to look at it and then explain to me what it is and where she got it. And based upon what I hear, I can accept it. And Mrs. McElveen, you call her, you remain under oath?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
What is that document and where did you get it?
This document is a lawsuit of financial resources and assistance of the Lakes Region against National Inspection and Repair Company and David Price. The date of it is, this went to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. The date was June 13th, 2005. I received this from Ron and Jackie Stone. It was part of their case. Part of their evidence. The significance to this is that there were a lot of people who were invested in NIR. I believe Don and Elizabeth Gates to be one of the current victims who had been invested in NIR.
If I recall, the monetary level in this was like $717,000 or $718,000, something of that nature. Am I correct in that?
I think he had actually advanced $300,000 to NIR. His partner in this particular scheme, his name was Ron Provat. He had forwarded a check to NIR, a personal check to NIR, for $1 million. NIR wrote checks against that deposit. The $1 million check bounced.
So you retrieved this document from information collected by the Stones?
Yes. Yes. And in here on page 7, it makes the allegation that Scott, page 6 and 7, financial resources does not segregate funds in the VBT account, VBT being Village Bank and Trust. Instead, all investor funds are pooled into a, quote, slush fund, unquote, which is then used by Farah for any purpose he, quote, sees fit, unquote. And I think that's the important point. And also, at one time, Andrea Shaw requested all litigation against FRMA National, whatever name they were going by at that point. There's an email in April of 2006, I think, where she's asking someone in banking to gather all of the litigation against FRM. Whether or not Andrea Shaw ever received that, I don't know. I believe Scott Farah won that case.
I'm familiar with the case. I'm familiar with it.
I believe he got a judgment for well over $1 million.
What we have is Chris Carter's brief for the appellants in the 2005 case. The brief is unsigned and uncertified, which causes me some problems.
Okay.
It causes me problems because I don't know that's the final version of his brief. I don't know that it was forward in an appropriate manner. I understand the purpose for which you have offered this. I'm going to tell you, I sit here convinced already of what you have purported to have shown me, and I'm well aware of it from other facts that have evolved since October of this situation. I am absent the signatures, reluctant. In fact, I'm not going to take it.
Okay.
If I may, Mr. Chandler, if something you would like, I can speak to Mr. Carter and try to obtain the documents for him.
Well, I understand the purpose for which this is being entered. Ms. McElvain has been quite clear. I sit here convinced today of the position that she articulated and the purpose for this. It would do no harm to get a signed copy, and I would accept it. But as my kids say, don't beat your brains out. I'm there already on this one.
A question, I guess. Should the New Hampshire Attorney General's office have known about that lawsuit?
Well, I'm not sure I'm the person who can answer that.
Okay.
But I think you know the answer.
Are we done?
Let's try and get the signed certified copy of that. It's going to be a lot of work over the next 30 days, but if we can get that without tremendous difficulty, sure.
I'll make that effort, and I'll keep you apprised of how that's going.
I don't want you spending a week trying to get that.
Do my best.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The next document I wish to provide to you is the testimony of Michael Krebs in front of the Joint Legislative Committee. This is his testimony speaking of the report that he produced for the Attorney General's office that was used in conjunction with their Department of Justice report on financial resources. In other words, basically, this testimony, I think, will reveal to you, Mr. Chandler, and you probably already know this, but Mr. Krebs did not look at any actual FRM mortgage instruments. It was more of a theoretical analysis, and I just thought this testimony would help shed some additional information for you behind that process.
I think it's well established that in his work for the Office of the Attorney General, Mr. Krebs did not, in fact, look at documents from FRM involving FRM, but I will accept that. That is a copy of a transcript, is that correct?
That is a copy of a transcript that I printed off of the legislative website, yes.
Oh, okay.
It's not the entire day, just a portion of Mr. Krebs' testimony.
That's fine. I'm going to accept that, and I'm going to ask that that be marked.
Is 119.
Okay, thank you. Is Michelle back on Monday?
Yes.
Tuesday, we're off on Monday.
Oh, yeah. Okay. On Tuesday, could we ask her to email to me an updated evidence list? Okay.
The next thing I have for you, Mr. Chandler, I believe you've already seen all the Attorney General memorandums. There were a bunch of them that were created.
I have them here.
There's one that I don't believe you have seen yet, and it's my understanding this is the last one in existence. It's Mr. Mark Connolly's.
Oh, really?
There's a memorandum that we've obtained on him. So this is Mark Connolly's memorandum dated May 13, 2010. The authors of this document are Christopher Marshall and Richard Head, and it is their notes on the interview, but not an actual transcript. As
I understand, as are all the others.
As are all the others.
Yeah.
And as
is significantly impacted by the testimony of Attorney Shepard this afternoon.
And along with that, Mr. Connolly has offered to you a correction for the record of the statements made in here. He has addressed pretty much paragraph by paragraph whatever inconsistencies he's found. And he's
excellent.
He would like to enter that in conjunction with this.
Absolutely take that.
And lastly, with this, Mr. Connolly also has a statement regarding the issue with the hearings examiner, and he wishes me to add that with the statement as well. He sent that to me right afterwards and said, could you add this in there as well? It's his clarification on his understanding of the issue of the hearings examiner as it relates to
that. Let me have a look at that.
If you want to review that first. You're not going to like it in email fashion, though.
No, I'm not. Well, no, I'm not going to like that.
It's something I can certainly get signed and mailed to me if that would be...
That's, I'll accept it in that when you get it signed and mailed to you.
Okay.
But we have the actual memorandum from the
AG's office. Memorandum from the AG's office and Mr. Connolly's response to it. This is not an email form, but it's not signed. But it's signed Mark Connolly, typewritten, but not signature. Is that going to be an issue? Because I can also just have him supplement that as well.
I think I'd like that supplemented too.
So for now, I'll just give the Attorney General memorandum and ask for the signature and ask Mr. Connolly to go through that proper channel.
Well, I'll accept those two with the caveat you're going to secure a signature on the corrective component and you're going to secure it on the email. I don't want the email.
When I give you this email one, I'll give you an updated sign.
That's fine.
Okay.
Bear with me for a minute.
We'll get a signature by next week, I'm sure.
Excellent. Do you have any idea why we didn't have this statement earlier?
I think we didn't get it originally. We got it a lot later than we got the other set of Attorney General memorandums, and then I think maybe Jeff would be a better person to ask that question.
I received all the statements and stuff from Mr. Connolly's, and then I emailed the Attorney General's office and asked them, you know, do you have that? And I received it maybe a couple weeks after the original statements. And this was in, I'd say, probably received about the middle of January.
Okay.
And by the way, another reason for the delay is I asked Mr. Connolly, since you didn't hear from him, and since we wanted to be complete here, I asked Mr. Connolly if he wanted his statement submitted. And I think he took a while to think about it. And I'm sure he wanted to address the aspects of the statement he thought were inaccurate.
That's
so
what
he put that together.
That's what I assumed when I asked you the timeline, because I assumed that he had seen this and then deferred to the corrections.
Right. I mean, and it took a while to put that together.
I'm sure it did. What's that?
Yes. Exhibit 120.
120.
The next thing I have for you is Jeffrey Spill's phone log, and this is just evidence for you to see the various communications from 2001 through 2006 that Jeff made. It's been alleged that the Bureau of Security Regulation didn't reach out to other departments, and we just wanted to offer this to you as evidence of Mr. Spill's phone log where he was reaching out.
Are there any parts of that phone log that should be redacted that are not?
I think it should be entered under seal due to the fact that there are several other communications
that's
unrelated.
That's what I was wondering.
Would you like it under seal?
I would like that under seal. I have Mr. Spill's, some of your phone log earlier entered into evidence. And I forget the issue, but
I entered a phone log. I reviewed Mr. Spill's phone log for any communications from Chris Carter.
That's
an issue there. But
yes.
I only interviewed looked at a 2-year period, and I submitted that. This is Mr. Spill's look at a larger period of time with a different look for communications to other departments.
That's the entire log.
Entire log.
Okay.
The present.
Okay. Yeah. We'll enter that. That definitely will be under seal.
Actually, I have a folder going on the market under seal here.
Yeah, let's do that. Whoops.
That would be number 121.
121.
And Mr. Chandler, the SEC has recently come, they've recently dropped their case against Center Harbor Christian Church, I believe, and they've also recently dropped their case against Robert Farah. And it's my understanding that there's final orders in respect to Scott Farah, his charge against the SEC. Maybe you can explain it better, but we're waiting to get the finalized proposed consent agreement, right? This is only the proposed one, where we didn't know if Mr. Chandler wanted.
It has been finalized. I think as of
a couple of days ago, very recently, this case with the SEC has been finalized, and we're waiting the documents to show the finalization of that process. And we thought maybe it would shed some light for you, and you would want that. So what I'm asking you now is if, along with these other documents I'll be submitting next week, if you'd like the SEC's agreements with Scott or Donald Dodge.
Oh, absolutely. And
what I have here is just the proposed orders that we had, and then they were made official since I received this, and we haven't received the.
No, let's get the official orders. We're going to have that go onto the record for the purpose of accepting, getting documents in at some point next week anyway without having evidence. When we do that, Mr. Forcier, I want notices created so that the public is aware that we're going to open for, it's just going to be the receipt of documents. I don't think people have to travel in. Listen,
we can announce the day on the website that beforehand, and we can announce that it's just for the purpose of accepting the documents. There will be no testimony. We can announce the day, the room, the time, everything else. Yeah. We'll make sure we leave the a statement there that it's just for documents, and there won't
right.
be any testimony. Yeah. I'd like to refer to Mr. Spill before I make a closing statement.
Mr. Spill.
Yes, thank you. There's a couple of documents that you might find instructive with respect to finalizing the report and getting the sequence of events. In the DOJ report, with respect to the request for a joint exam by banking,
yes,
we believe they got the sequence of events wrong.
Okay.
These documents will clarify what this, I think will clarify what the sequence of events was. They stated in their report that by reply voicemail on May 4th, 06, Securities Bureau told Banker that they would go separately. And then they wrote, on May 4th, I wrote a letter to Attorney Maloney regarding the Concord Monitor article and requested a meeting at FRM. The call doesn't appear in my phone log, but these are the billing records from the Gallagher firm, and I did call Mr. Maloney to arrange that meeting. I believe in the early hours of business day on May 4th. I did not mention the banking's desire to do a joint exam. What happened was, I believe this is my best recollection, I think Mr. Glenn verbally told me that that was banking's desire, and I was waiting to speak to the director about that request. I was also concerned about the article that appeared in the paper, as was banking. The entry in the phone log is telephone conference with Attorney Spill of New Hampshire Bureau of Securities Regulation, RE. Further investigative request, Ari news article, telephone message to Mr. Farrow's office, Ari saying. There's been a lot made about this request for a joint exam, and I think it's been overemphasized to the point where it's being portrayed as something that was really pivotal, I guess, is what the word they use. But I was obviously very interested in speaking to Mr. Farrer and Mr. Maloney about this article that appeared in the paper, and I made arrangements to call. I made arrangements to go up there with Mr. Maloney with this phone call. I don't believe I understood at the time that banking wanted to do it on an unannounced basis.
Okay.
But in any event, I have a letter from Mr. Maloney verifying that I did not mention that banking wanted to go and do an exam.
Weren't you, in fact, at the end of the settlement process on the securities issue?
Yes.
That curative process at that point in time had not concluded, if my recollection is correct. You were near the conclusion.
Right.
But it had not yet concluded.
We did not know that banking had seen all these problems, and it was obviously much stronger on their radar screen than it was to us.
But your regulatory process was underway relative to 3.3 $3 million. Is that the extent of the resolution?
Well, certainly if you wanted to put a timeline on it, I felt we were more towards the end of the matter than at the beginning.
Right.
And I had no idea where banking was because we had tried to get the audited reports and we didn't get the information. But the request came through as just a request without any background information or supportive information whatsoever. And it wasn't until later on in the day that I left a voicemail to Ms. Gerder saying that I had an appointment, and I had put a letter in the mail to Mr. Maloney and we had made the decision later in the day that we would go separately, and then I told Ms. Gerda. I just didn't want you to get the impression that we had made the decision to go separately, and then I made the appointment with Mr. Maloney.
Okay.
To make it appear as though we had that appointment, that appointment was already in play when we made the decision to go separately. So that's the letter from Mr. Maloney and the billing record.
And how did you secure the billing record?
Through counsel for Mr. Maloney, Alan Cronin. My recollection is I didn't get to deal. The request came in from Mr. Glenn, and he told me verbally I didn't get to deal with the issue until that day. And that's when the sequence of events occurred on the 4th.
Okay.
So it's clear, I didn't confer with the director until after I wrote the letter, until after I spoke to Mr. Maloney.
Thank you. That can be marked.
Okay. That would be Exhibit 122.
Okay.
Mr. Chandler, in the course of our investigation, we learned that there's a company by the name of SkillMed Services Incorporated. Turns out Scott Farah was a part owner of that company for the first year. He was also the secretary, the treasurer, in charge of writing checks. Long story short, he was voted off as a director of the company 1 year after he became involved. The company ends up going bankrupt, and there was a bunch of money that was raised by investors that is nowhere to be found. Ms. Bonnie McPhail, who was the owner of the company, also filed for bankruptcy. She fled the state, ended up moving to Oklahoma. Long story short, we were just trying to see if any... I went to post-secondary education and went through their files to see if there was any indication that anybody in government may have been aware of Scott Farah as far back as 04 or 05 when this was occurring. Long story short, I just came across three different complaints that I have here in front of me that I offer to you. These three complaints originated at the Attorney General's Office, Consumer Protection Division. It was students of this school, SkillMed Services, were calling because they weren't getting refunds in a timely manner. There were several complaints that they were making because in regards to Ms. McPhail's running of the company. Classes were being shut down. The school wasn't functioning as it properly should, and they weren't getting the refunds as they were promised. So long story short, they started calling the Attorney General's Office to complain. Post-Secondary Education Commission is the entity that licenses SkillMed. So what my interpretations are, at the Attorney General Consumer Protection's Office referred these complaints to Post-Secondary Education. The reason why I offer them to you is because the three that I have in front of me is one of 20-something complaints that I reviewed at Post-Secondary. Not all of those 20-something complaints came through the Attorney General's Office. Some of them went directly to Post-Secondary. But I think if I had to guess, there was 8, 9, or 10 that originated in the Attorney General's Office. But these three I pulled aside because they allege criminal conduct in them. The very first one, dated May 605, is signed by 7 of the students of SkillMed. They allege in this complaint serious criminal conduct that I felt, it does not use Scott Farah's name directly. It talks about Scott Farah as the pastor's son, who was Bonnie's financial partner, who had stolen the money from the company. And it does say other serious allegations, such as mafia and drug connections. And these criminal allegations were, in my opinion, overlooked and just referred to the Post-Secondary Education Commission. In my opinion, had such a substantial allegation made by seven different people who sign and leave their phone numbers, although the focus of the complaint may have been SkillMed and their issues with refunds, they make serious criminal allegations in here. For that very reason, I thought it would be something you'd want to review as part of your record. These other two complaints are similar in nature. They don't use as strong as language as the first one, but they allege embezzlement. And these also get forwarded to post-secondary. And from every indication, no further review on the criminal allegations therein. I thought it would shed some additional information on how Scott Farah operated. And there's been past testimony, specifically Susan Brochu, and she said something along the lines of that Scott Farah may be involved in organized crime. I think this would shed some additional light on that as well, because some similar allegations are made in the first of these three complaints. And I just want to bring them to your attention because I thought they would add credibility to Ms. Brochu's testimony as well as shed some light on how Scott Farah operated. We haven't heard any testimony where Scott joined a company, became a director of a company, and ran to the ground. And I think this is what we have here. So I offer this to you if you wish to accept it.
I don't wish to accept it. And it let me say that they are highly provocative documents. And if I were sitting here today investigating the internal operations of the Office of the Attorney General, I would be extremely interested in those. However, the charge given to me by the Secretary of State is such that while they give strong evidence of additional criminality on the part of Scott Farah, they don't have a mention, and I'm familiar with the documents. In any of those documents, there is no mention nor tie to FRM. There is no mention or tie to CLNM Inc. The name Scott Farah is not used in any of those documents. The reference is a pastor's son. I think those documents are meaningful in another form, and I would hope that somebody would look at those and find out what else fell through the cracks here. It's a serious matter. Basically, what happened in my view is a business entity run by someone for educational purposes was made a victim, just as someone who came together to lend money on a real estate loan. They just didn't do it under the auspices of FRM or CLNM Inc. These are yet other victims of Scott Farah using a different methodology. I'm sure a lot of work went into finding those documents, but I don't think that they're appropriate in this forum, but they certainly are appropriate in some other forum.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I anticipate you would say that because it doesn't use the words Scott Farah nor FRM, but in the course of my investigation, having revealed those, I felt the need to show them to you, for you to make that decision.
It's appropriate.
I'd just like to close with a short statement.
Please do.
The Bureau of Securities Director, Joseph Long, his statement of policy only reiterates the position that promissory notes coupled with real or chattel mortgages are not treated as securities under New Hampshire law. Frank Giacumis, supervisor of securities in the 1970s, testified that this was a position since the 1950s. Roughly 35 people testified at these hearings, and every one of them believed that their loans were secured by real or chattel mortgages. No testimony throughout our hearings revealed that FRM was dealing in securities beyond the unsecured promissory notes and the preferred shareholders that were already found. FRM, to me, seems as though they exited the securities business in early 2007 after they consented with the Bureau and bought out their last remaining shareholder. FRM would then focus on the loophole that we seem to have found in commercial real estate lending. In 2006, the banking department invited the Bureau of Securities Regulation on a joint audit. What banking didn't do is provide any context to that invitation. They didn't tell the Bureau of Securities about any of the many problems they had discovered during the course of their 2001, 2003, and 2004 audits, or the several complaints they had received. The Bureau of Securities Regulation was already working with FRM to buy out the preferred shareholders and unsecured noteholders. Had banking revealed everything that was going on with FRM at the time they made that invitation, had they revealed even some of it, maybe things would have been differently. It's been said that the Bureau of Securities acted unreasonably and didn't share information. I think that that has been shown to be completely false. The record shows that the Bureau of Securities reached out to banking to try to learn the results of their audit in 2003 and were denied that information. The record shows that the Bureau of Securities reached out to the Attorney General's office for an asset freeze in 2003 and again were denied that request. Or was that request even addressed at all? Jeffrey Spill of the Bureau of Securities met with Susan Gorman of the Attorney General's office in an attempt to get an asset freeze on FRM in 2003. Unsure from this meeting with Ms. Gorman whether they would pursue it, the record shows that Jeffrey Spill followed up this meeting with a letter and documents to Susan Gorman, and the letter literally says, "I will wait to hear from you regarding the issue of securing assets for the benefit of the investors." How can anyone read that letter and believe that Jeffrey Spill knew that a decision had been rendered when he left that meeting? If he understood that they weren't going to take any action, why would he write that letter, and why would he send documents? The Attorney General's office never responded to Jeff's letter or answered his request. How can it be said that the Bureau of Securities didn't reach out to other agencies when it's clear that the Bureau reached out to both banking and the AG's office? That statement is simply not true. In sum, I think these hearings have made it clear that the Bureau acted appropriately and within its jurisdiction. Thank you.
Mr. Spill, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
Yes, briefly. The question that you asked all the victims of this terrible tragedy that I thought was most poignant is very instructive was, did you intend to invest in any business? And the answer was always no. And I agree with fellow counsel, Mr. Forsey, that the policy statement is very instructive on the issue of the difference between a security and not a security. And in this case, it's not a security because there was no intent to invest in any business such as FRM or CLNM. It was a loan, the repayment of which was not contingent upon the profitability of any business, but upon the payment back to the lender. And that's really the key to all this. And I echo the sentiments of Mr. Force here that this has been the history of the Bureau. There is, to our knowledge, no legal precedent in the state that would conclude otherwise. And we view these instruments as loans and not as securities. And I would ask that the lender's testimony and the policy statement of Mr. Long be the deciding factors here as to whether the Bureau acted properly or not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for conducting this proceeding. It's been very instructive.
Well, it certainly has. And before I close for the day and potentially the last day, I just want to say a couple things. I want to thank primarily the victims, the people who found the time, the energy, and the courage to come forward and help me understand a very complex process. I've practiced law for 30 years. I understand these things, but I don't know that anybody truly understands the pain, the anguish, and the financial terror that was caused by this horrible Ponzi scheme. I think I do now, and I think I do now because of the level of effort primarily that the victims put in to come forward and help educate me. I will endeavor to continue to work hard and come up with the best possible findings of fact and report that I can to help guide the components of this state that, by God, need some guidance. So with that, I'm going to close the hearing.
Thank you.
I want to say thank you very much.